Our next speaker is John Feit. He's one of our,
physical therapist.
Physical therapist slash former Katy ISD graduate. So he's a local boy, yep. Done good. So please welcome John.
With this presentation, I hope to just kind of expand your knowledge, pique interest, and maybe widen your lens when discussing pain or treating people in pain, which we all do. So background for me, I went to Texas State, grew up in Katy. I did a lot of rotation work, clinicals around chronic pain. I worked at the county for 7 months. So working around the county, I treated people in chronic pain every day, and that's what piqued my interest. And now I practice at Memorial Hermann in Katy. So our goals are, we're gonna define pain, we're gonna distinguish chronic from acute pain, discuss the evolution of pain, pain science, and what it is and what it isn't. And then hopefully by the end of the day, we can understand the role of the nervous system in the processing of pain. As far as evidence-based practice, all of us have clinical expertise, but there's two other tiers with it. It's best external evidence. And so the literature is kind of going this way, away from the traditional biomedical model, more towards the biopsychosocial model. And then obviously your patient's values and expectations also matter, which is huge for pain science. So you need to be talking to your patients, not talking at them, talking with them. So pain as an overview, this is kind of like y'all's dynamic warm-up for your brain, okay? So back all the way back into the oldest days, we can have pain. The current definition is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, right? So the key is it's actual or potential, described in terms of such damage. Now, pain is a distressing experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage. That's what today's definition is, along with sensory, emotional, cognitive, and social components. So these are the components that we're now adding. And as we'll see with the presentation, the more we learn chronic pain, the less we know about pain, right? It's more complex than it is simple. So acute pain is any normal physiologic and time-limited response to an adverse stimulus. So you strain a muscle based on how much blood flow that muscle gets is how fast it heals, right? So textbook answer should be better in 4 to 6 weeks, depending on the strain. Compare that to bone. If you fracture a bone, it's obviously going to take longer to heal, 3 to 4 months. That's acute pain. Pain goes away when the tissues heal and your patient or athlete is better, right? Chronic pain, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is pain that persists 3 to 6 months or longer. So this person's tissues have healed, however, they still have a pain problem. If you look at the prevalence of chronic pain, this is a diagram of just the top comorbidities in the United States. So you have diabetes, coronary heart disease. As far as chronic pain, it's more than all of those combined. So it demands some attention. If you look at the literature, as far as the interventions, it's all over the map. Anytime it's all over the map, there's not a gold standard. So we really haven't figured out how to best treat this yet. And that's understandable, right? It's very difficult. We all have had these people, young females with knee pain for 8 months to a year, right? It's getting deep into a year, we don't know what to do. So for these patients, you can't give them a walk to run interval program. It's not standard. It's not very simple. It's more complex. Every patient's pain experience is different, and that patient's pain experience is different every day, depending on the situation. This is a quote from Scott Fishman. He's a chief of pain medicine in the University of California. Doctors are so undertrained in treating chronic pain that we just have not done as well in quality of life as we've done in quantity of life. So our patients are living longer and sometimes their quality of life isn't getting any better. As far as physical therapists, just for an example, we have 18 subsections in our APTA, all of which our patient's chief complaint is usually pain. And so now we're working on a pain section. So now we're trying to do things to capture what it is to be in pain. Evolution of pain, right? Let's just kind of get warmed up to what pain is. It originated with a philosopher named Descartes in the 17th century, and he proposed that our body had a brain, which is one entity, and then our body was another. So you had a brain and a body, which were two separate entities. He coined the specificity theory. So he said it was proposed that an injury to the periphery activated a specific pain receptor that projected a pain signal to a specific pain center in the brain via a specific pain pathway. So Descartes, his specificity theory said, if this man touched this fire, you had a pain receptor which would send a pain signal to your brain. In that brain, you had a pain center, right? So these are all pain pathways. Specificity theory led to a laundry list of neurosurgical techniques in an attempt to treat chronic pain, right? So, okay, let's find the pain pathway, let's find the pain center, and we'll just cut it out, right? And these chronic pain patients should get better. So that led to a laundry list of surgeries, cordotomies, rhizotomies, cortical ablations. Come to find out, these patients' pain would come back after surgery. After the specificity theory, there were several attempts to find a new theory, which led to the gait control theory, and that's primarily what we learned today in school. Ronald Melzack. So just a quick refresher in a nutshell, you had the specificity theory, right? And then we moved to the gate control theory. Gate control theory, they said there's still pain fibers, right? Still pain fibers, but now there's a gate within the spinal cord. So you have the large fiber and the small fibers. And in the gate control theory, the best thing that came out of that was they said the brain also played an active role in pain modulation. So your brain was no longer just a passive receiver. So there was descending nerve impulses from your brain, which would help modulate pain. Gate control theory led to Shaq's TENS unit, right? Everyone knows what TENS is from Shaq on his commercials. So that's fun. Okay, now we're going to take specificity theory, gate control theory, and just throw in a few examples. So some shortcomings of past beliefs. Specificity theory and the gate control theory all created assumptions that the experience of pain was always associated with tissue damage. When's the last time you looked down, you saw a big nasty bruise on your leg, right? A bruise is a sign of tissue damage. So inherently, if you have a bruise, if you take the specificity theory, if you have a bruise and damaged tissues, you should be experiencing pain at that moment, right? But a lot of times you look down, you're like, I don't remember hitting a desk. I don't remember slamming my foot into the wall. I don't remember doing anything, but I have signs of tissue damage. Then you have the elderly population, right? They get bruised if they just bounce into a physio ball. Oh, honey, it doesn't hurt. It's just pain. You know, it just looks bad. So you can have tissue damage without pain, and you can have pain without tissue damage. It goes both ways. All right, so they assume there's a linear relationship between the sensation of pain and the amount of tissue damage. So more tissue damage means you should have more pain. There's a one-to-one ratio. So you take the specificity theory, y'all remember Kevin Ware? This is a pretty serious fracture, right? Tons of tissue damage, inherently this should hurt a lot. Compound fracture. After the game, he said it was one of those things where I couldn't believe it. I honestly didn't feel the pain, it was more shock. And then you can see his teammates throwing up on the bench. Some of them were like grabbing his leg, like grabbing their legs, like their leg hurt, but it wasn't their leg. So all these things are very complex, it's not simple. Compare that to a paper cut, right? That's like inherently a small amount of tissue damage. But in my eyes, that looks like it hurts more than his actual leg. Because to me, I've never had a compound fracture. I don't remember what that feels like. But I can tell you the last time I had a paper cut, it hurt like hell. And that's a small amount of tissue damage, right? So there's not a linear relationship. You can have a small amount of tissue damage with a lot of pain, and you can have a lot of tissue damage without pain. So pain science means pain is very complex, and it's not simple. So specificity theory, gate control theory, they don't account for social context, such as the experience of pain being influenced by who is around. So in this study, they took a bunch of men, put them into a room, and they used an algometer, which is this guy, and they're trying to find pressure pain threshold. So sits down, subject A, hey, I'm gonna mash on your arm as hard as I can. Tell me as soon as you feel pain. Ow, I have pain. How many pounds of force was that, right? So they do the same study with their female counterpart in the room, and their pressure pain thresholds went up. So if their female counterpart was in the room, they could take more pressure before saying, hey, this is painful, right? This is the whole macho stimulus thing. Pain's influenced by who is around. And you see that with athletes and parents all the time. Like sometimes you get the athlete's parents out of the room, they do better all of a sudden, right? There's correlations to what's going on around the patient. This is a pretty cool story, studied by Lormer Mosley. So they took 33 people all at different times. They put their hand on a table. Okay, hands on the table. And they have an aluminum probe. They put this aluminum probe in a freezer. So this probe is sitting at a constant -4 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? So it's very cold, right? And it's cold for everybody, it's -4 degrees. So all 33 individuals put their hand on the table, and on that aluminum probe were two lights, okay? One was blue and one was red. Now they told the subjects, hey, the blue light indicates cold, and the red light indicates hot, right? So -4 degrees Fahrenheit probe for everybody in there. Right before the probe hit them on the hand, the light would change colors. Some of the individuals turned blue, some turned red, right? And then they had that person on the numeric pain rating scale tell them from 0 to 10 how much it hurt. So which one do you think hurt worse, the blue or the red? So if the red is associated with hot, obviously you want to protect yourself from a fire. Although you can go to your, you know, you can go to your ice machine and carry ice around for 10 minutes and ice doesn't hurt. So blue is not a threat to somebody, but red is. So it's the same amount of temperature. However, in that social experience, they told the person what it's going to feel like. So they wanted to protect themselves even more from red. So pain is also influenced by sensory cues. Biggest argument for people who are doing this whole battle of pain science is, explain to me how you can have phantom limb pain. So this man does not have a left foot, correct? Phantom limb pain says, okay, this guy doesn't have a left foot. However, his left foot hurts. So if you take the specificity theory, how is that pain getting to this man's pain center in his brain, but there's no specific pain pathway coming from the foot to the leg? Doesn't make sense, right? You can't say that. Now take the gait control theory. So, okay, yeah, now we have large fibers and small fibers, but how do those signals get to the gait, right, in his spinal cord? This man has pain in his foot, but he doesn't have a leg. It's kind of complex. The answer lies in the brain, okay? So pain science is leading everyone to look closer in the brain. So where do we go from here? It's the nervous system, okay? The nervous system is 2% of our body weight. It consumes 20% of the available oxygen in your bloodstream. So it's always on, it's always working, and it's always being used. All right, now we're gonna talk about what pain science says so far. This is Lorimer Moseley. He says, we tend to endorse the complexity of the brain and its fundamental role in what we experience, unless, of course, we are talking about pain. So everyone talks about how complex the brain is, neuroplasticity, all these cool, exciting things. But when we talk about pain, we make it very simple. And that's what we're learning is not the case. So the sensation of pain is our body's danger alarm system. So now we're leading towards, it's not a pain system, it's a danger alarm system. And this system has evolved for thousands of years to tell the brain about the changes that occur in our body's tissues, right? So it's a danger alarm system, it's not a pain system. And its primary purpose is to warn the brain when we are in danger, okay? It doesn't warn us when we're in pain, it warns us when we're in danger. So just like thirst and hunger, the sensation of pain is created by our brain in order for us to survive. So pain is purposeful and pain is meant to protect us. If you're stepping with barefoot and you step on a hot nail, red hot nail, it's gonna hurt, you're gonna look, and you're not gonna step on the next one, right? So it serves a purpose. So an example of pain protecting us is an ankle sprain, right? We see these all the time. So this newlywed, they went hiking, couples, it's all a good day, everyone's good feelings, and this guy, he sprains his ankle pretty bad, right? So 2 days later, it looks like this. So if someone sprains their ankle, there's a cascade of things that happen. He's gonna walk different, right? He's gonna have an intelligent gait, he's gonna offload it, there's gonna be swelling, signs of inflammatory process right there. That's acute pain, that's purposeful pain. It's protecting this person from continuing to put weight on their foot, right? If their ankle is trying to heal, you can't continue to load the tissue. You have to give it time to heal. So pain's meant to protect us, and it's not a bad thing. Unless we're talking about chronic pain, where the tissues have healed, and now it's the sensitivity of your nervous system, not the tissue. So take Hansen's disease or leprosy, right? This is an example of pain not protecting us. So it's a chronic infectious disease that attacks the peripheral nervous system, causing your body's natural alarm system to fail. So now, for these people, the brain no longer receives danger messages. So they don't have a danger protective system. And what happens with that is it eventually leads to self-mutilation, right? So they've been stepping on nails, they've been stubbing their toes for years, and their body's tissues are just slowly dying, right? And this leads eventually to sepsis and death. So to be able to feel pain is a gift. And a lot of times we forget that when talking to people, we discredit it. Say, hey man, good thing, your body is just telling you the speed limit after surgery or after an injury, right? So pain is not the end all. It's okay to have pain as long as it's appropriate. So our body's danger alarm system, this is where we're kind of leading towards. So the command center for this alarm system is your brain, like we discussed. And this is where the future of pain science lies. So it becomes obvious the importance of this command center because it's housed in your skull, right? So your most protective organ is your brain. It's inside this big, large, bony mass, and it's literally floating in cerebrospinal fluid. So obviously your body is meant to protect it. It's pretty important. Followed by its sub-command center, which is your spinal cord, and it's also protected by big bony structures as well. And there's a reason for this. So the human body consists of millions of sensors that are constantly surveying the area for activity and relaying information to the command center. So your body's nervous system is always on. It's 2% of your body weight, and it consumes 20% of your available oxygen. So on one cubic centimeter in your brain, which is about the size of your fingertip, you have 1 billion synapses in your brain. That's a lot of stuff going on. It's super complex. Sensors are housed in your body's neurons, okay? You have mechanical, temperature, and chemical sensitive neurons as well. But more importantly for your danger alarm system, you have nociceptors. So nociception is the big buzzword if you're talking pain science now. So it's no longer a danger signal, it's a nociceptive signal. Some of these neurons are specialized to respond to all types of stimuli if they find that stimuli are sufficient to be dangerous to the tissues, okay? So it's not a painful stimulus, it's a dangerous stimulus. Activation of these special neurons send a prioritized alarm signal, not a pain signal. We don't have pain yet. We have a danger signal, then alarm signal being sent from the periphery to your spinal cord, and then to your brain. So if you look at this man right here, he has a paper cut. We all talked about how painful that is, right? He gets a paper cut, he's shuffling papers. He's done this hundreds of times. We've all been students. You turn pages in books and things like that, and he gets a paper cut, right? So immediately his nociceptors are picking up some increased activity in his finger. So paper cut, you get nociception. Now his nociceptors are sending a danger signal to his spinal cord. Once that danger signal gets to his spinal cord, to his brain, it's going to clue his brain in to check out what's going on. He's going to look down, oh man, my finger's bleeding, I have a paper cut. Last time this happened, it hurt really bad. Boom, here comes pain. Your brain has to create this experience to have the output of pain. And at the end of the day, your brain is your body's kind of alarm system, pain system. So pain's eventually an output of your brain 100% of the time. That's as simple as pain sign gets. So it's nociception, it's a danger signal, it's not a pain signal. It gets sent to your spinal cord, danger signal gets sent to your brain. Brain has to decide what's going on. Is this truly a threat? Yes, this is a threat. You're bleeding. Ouch, this hurts. Now you're feeling pain. When in the past, if you cut your finger, tissue damage equated to pain, right? Pain signal to your brain. It's not the case. So if you look at how neurons communicate, it's through electrical impulses that are sent within a specific threshold. It's crossed, creating an action potential. Really fancy for saying your nervous system's on all the time, right? It's 2% of your body weight, but consumes 20% of your oxygen. So your nociceptors, your neurons, are always surveying your body for something new. Y'all been sitting here for 2 days. These are new chairs, right? Your butt might start to hurt. So these are all things you usually do in your activities of daily living. You sit in a chair you've never sat in for 2 days, your butt's going to hurt. So your nociceptors and your butt are saying, hey, this chair's really uncomfortable, right? You're like, yeah, I haven't sat here before, but is it a threat? No. So you move around, right? You move around a little bit. Okay, this feels better. I'm going to offload a certain area. The threat's gone. So your brain says, hey, everything's okay. Right? Compare that to, you know, you have a new t-shirt. Sometimes you pull the tag off, you still have that little plastic thing in there, right? So you're sitting here, you have your clothes on, which everyone always does, hopefully. Your body feels the clothes on your back, right? This is not new, I always do this. But you have this one spot that's poking over and over again. So you get this nociception, right? So this area that's getting touched, your nociceptors there are saying, hey, there's something different here. Danger signal gets sent to your spinal cord. Hey, something's going on in my shoulder. Spinal cord says, yep, sends it up to your brain. Brain says, hey, have I been here before? Yep, I've never been in this room in for 2 days. Yesterday, did somebody touch me on the back? Yeah, somebody did. Let me look. Nobody's behind me, right? Your brain is trying to figure this story out. Let's look into it further. So you reach and you touch. Now you have the sensory cues, right? Oh, what is this tag? This is a new shirt, right? So now your brain's trying to figure out what just happened. You pull the tag out, thread is gone, and then your nociceptors go back to work. That's how nociception happens in its most basic form. So again, you have a noxious stimulus to the periphery, right? That causes the danger signal, not a pain signal. It activates a neuron to send a danger message to your spinal cord. Once the message reaches the spinal cord, chemicals are dumped to your synapse, okay? Spinal cord sends it to your brain. Then and only then, once your brain receives this danger message, it can truly decide if you need to produce the feeling, the sensation of pain. The brain has to construct as sensible a story as possible based on all the information that is arriving at the time and the danger messages are received. You have to use information such as sight, taste, touch, smell, emotions, and even past memories. So usually it's way more complex than it is simple with athletes who've had pain for a long time. So the brain has to decide if there's danger, is truly a threat. Now this is the cool part, right? So however, it's not a one-way street as the brain can influence what is going on with danger messages arriving at the spinal cord. The brain contains hormones that can descend into the spinal cord and dampen down the alarm signals. So your brain has an internal drug cabinet, right? We all know about the opioid epidemic, all this stuff. But your brain also has its own hormones. So everybody's brain has its internal drug cabinet that can be accessed with these persistent pain patients if they're educated properly and the communication is there. The hormones make the sensors less excited, which in turn make it less likely to send a danger message to the brain. So the brain plays an active role in pain modulation. It's not just a passive receiver like the past. Carries drugs, 96 Olympics. She had a severe ankle sprain towards the end of it. She had one more vault left, I think, to win the whole thing. So for her, right, her biggest threat at that time, she sprained her ankle, was not winning the Olympics. So usually if you're walking down the street, nothing's going on, you sprain your ankle, it's gonna hurt, right? Immediately you're gonna limp, you're like, man, this sucks, my day just got worse, and it's gonna be painful the whole time, right? So compare her to somebody crossing the road, right? You sprain your ankle and there's a bus coming at you. What's your biggest threat at that moment? Your eyes are saying, hey, this bus is gonna hit me, right? So you're not gonna feel pain at that time. You're gonna move on an injured ankle, right? Adrenaline's gonna hit, the internal drug cabinet's been open. So you're just fighting for your life.
2 hours later, you're like, why does my ankle hurt? Oh yeah, I sprained it when I was running from the bus, right? It's all conceptual. So for her, when she sprained her ankle, her biggest threat was not winning the Olympics. So yeah, man, I just tore my ankle up. She looks around, she sees the American flag, she hears the crowd, she has the past memories, 4 years, right, of training. She was like, I'm gonna power through this. So she's able to power through it, lands it, sticks it, they all win, right? That's a good pain story. Pain's complex, way more complex than it is simple. For those of us who have kids, right, it's pretty dramatic when they skin their ankles, skin their knees, especially if they haven't had a nap, it's even worse, right? Interesting enough, when you put a Band-Aid on them, it's immediately better. Now, I don't know, I haven't read the box, but I'm pretty sure Band-Aids don't just heal tissue immediately, right? So if some young child skins his knee, like, that's scary, that's a threat, and bleeding, there's exposed tissue, he's like, man, look at this granulation tissue, it's bleeding, like, I can only see my bone, so there's you know, they're crying, there's snot coming out, all this stuff. And then the mom comes over, slaps a Band-Aid on, right? Kid no longer sees the injury, so the Band-Aid covers it. It takes his vision from it, right? So that makes him feel better. It doesn't change the tissue quality, it's still torn, it's still an injury. He's got the mom's touch, right? The mom's touching him, saying, hey, it's okay, honey. Patting his back, so this is comforting, right? So his internal drug cabinet is opening. Like, this doesn't hurt. Mom's here, this is fine. She covers it up, she takes the threat away. He feels the mom touching him, saying it's gonna be better. So all these things play into someone's pain experience. So pain is way more complex than it is simple. And literally today, all I'm trying to do is pique your interest and widen your lens when discussing pain with patients. If something that doesn't add up, there's usually more going on between the ears than in the periphery, okay? And you have to get to the bottom of it. So lecture pearls, the experience of pain is meant to protect us, therefore it's purposeful. So don't beat around the bush when talking about pain with patients. It's very important they know exactly what's going on. The sensation of pain is driven by an alarm system. It's not a pain system. We don't have pain fibers, pain pathways, any of that. It's a danger system, which creates an alarm system. Nociceptors send danger signals from the periphery to the spinal cord, which may be then sent to the brain, and then your brain decides how this pain experience is going to pan out. And then most importantly, the brain plays an active role in dampening these signals at the spinal cord with endogenous hormones, your internal drug cabinet. So pain's an output of the brain 100% of the time. The brain can play an active role in modulating our patient's pain if they're educated correctly. So don't scare these people, right? It's not tissue pain, it's pain, it's neural pain. So now you're seeing a big shift from biomedical model to biopsychosocial. Like, hey, yeah, their tissues have time to heal, but they're still in pain. Let's see what's really going on. And it's a lot more complex and it can be draining, but usually it's a lot more fun than straightforward stuff. It takes a holistic approach. So when somebody's in pain, all they think about is pain. And then usually surrounded by that's an attitude of belief. So this is where you're gonna start changing. And then whatever distressors are in their life, usually there's some kind of major trauma in their life when this starts happens. And then look at their poor coping strategies, that they're avoiding it. It's just progressive tissue loading, right? Progressive tissue loading between the ears, figure out where they are, get the head on straight, and then start building these people up, right? Pain science is calming them down and building them up. And then always look around at social environment. Is it just cool to wear a brace? Do they always just want to wear a brace? You know, there's usually something going on.
Anybody have any questions? With some of our younger kids, most people do high school, but dealing with some of our junior high kids and they've never been hurt before, is this something that becomes, I guess, a learning process too, as well as if they learn to deal with pain in different ways? Or is there ways we can kind of help them to do that with some of our younger kids?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest thing with younger kids, the first thing I ask if somebody has chronic pain, like an athlete or somebody, and they've gone through traditional rehab or whatever, is like, what do you think's going on? Like, just ask them. Because usually it's some kind of thought or ideology in their head that they think, oh, when I feel this, it's that. So it's trying to restructure the way they think what pain is and what isn't. And a lot of times you have to learn what their biggest fear is and then educate them on like, oh, well, that's not the case at all, right? And then so what you should be feeling is, I mean, it just depends on the kid. It's very specific to the individuals, but it's how they interpret activity, pain. You should feel muscle versus this versus joint. So straightforward answers is complex, and it's all about asking the patient, like, hey, what do you think is going on? Like, what are you trying to protect yourself from? Because usually there's some kind of fear in there that they're afraid of something's going on. And so, for example, if somebody was like, had somebody come with a shoulder pain, he was 14, and nothing really looked straightforward in the eval. Nothing was fitting a pattern. And so we did the whole thing, and I was like, what do you think is going on? And it came out his mom had some kind of suprascapular nerve palsy. Well, my mom had this shoulder thing, and it led to having some, you know, revision of her scapula. It's like, I think I might be getting that. And I'm like, what? Like, no way, man. Like, if that was the case, all these muscles would be weak, your arm would look like this if you raised it. So it's like, we paint this picture of what it looks like to have that. You don't have that at all, right? So that's a shoulder example. I mean, usually it's back pain. I get a lot of athletes with back pain in there. Always have imaging. Imaging shows whatever degenerative changes, and then they're fearful to do everything. Like, I can't squat, I can't deadlift, right? If your imaging looked like that, but you had, drop foot and walking and all these different things, like, it's your pain is just because it's a poor movement pattern, and a lot of times you have to restructure what that looks like. And so it's literally progressive education and tissue loading. We'll reach back to squatting, like, this is not what you're feeling. So it's figuring out what that patient thinks is going on, what they're fearful of, and then building them back up. But I've had a lot of athletes come with back pain saying, like, I can't squat, I can't do this, because of these reasons, and it's all biomedical based off what the tissues and imaging show. And I'm like, man, that's not the case. Like, your pain is because you're hinging in your TL junction and you're not using your core. Like, you have a disc at L5 that's mildly bulged, but that's down here and your pain's up here. Like, there's always this disconnect. But until you tell that to the person, they don't understand it, right? And then it's all about educating them and getting them moving. So just ask what's going on in between the ears is where I usually start. And then you have to walk the talk with them and take them on this journey.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.